Chapter 39. Although fairly eclectic in 1888, L'Adore fashions were not quite as free as taken for granted at Ardis. For the grand picnic on her birthday, 16-year-old Ada wore a plain linen blouse, maize yellow slacks, and scuffed moccasins. Van had wanted her to let her hair down. She demurred, saying it was too long for country comfort, but finally compromised by tying it midway behind with a rumpled ribbon of black silk. Van's only observance of summer elegancies consisted of a blue polo jersey, knee-length gray flannel trousers, and sport creepers. While the rustic feast was being prepared and distributed among the sungouts of the traditional pine glade, the wild girl and her lover slipped away for a few moments of ravenous ardor in a ferny ravine where a rill dipped from ledge to ledge between tall burnberry bushes. The day was hot and breathless. The smallest pine had its cicada. She said, "Speaking as a character in an old novel, it seems so long, long ago, davnim davno, since I used to play word games here with Grace and two other lovely girls. Insect, incest, nicest." Speaking as a botanist and a madwoman, she said, the most extraordinary word in the English language was husked, because it stood for opposite things, covered and uncovered, tightly husked but easily husked, meaning they peel off quite easily. You don't have to tear the waistband, you brute. "Carefully husked brute," said Van tenderly. The passage of time could only enhance his tenderness for the creature he clasped, this adored creature, whose motion was now more supple, whose haunches had grown more lyrate, whose hair ribbon he had undone. As they crouched on the brink of one of the brook's crystal shelves, where, before falling, it stopped to have its picture taken and take pictures itself, Van, at the last throb, saw the reflection of Ada's gaze in the water flash a warning. Something of the sort had happened somewhere before. He did not have time to identify the recollection that, nonetheless, led him to identify at once the sound of the stumble behind him. Among the rugged rocks they found and consoled poor little Lucette, whose foot had slipped on a granite slab in a tangle of bushes. Flushed and flustered, the child rubbed her thigh in much overdone agony. Van and Ada gaily grasped one little hand each and ran Lucette back to the glade, where she laughed, where she flopped, where she made for her favorite tarts awaiting her on one of the unfolded tables. There she husked out of her sweatshirt, hitched up her green shorts, and, a squat on the russet ground, attacked the food she had collected. Ada had declined to invite anybody except the Erminen twins to her picnic, but she had no intention of inviting the brother without the sister. The latter, it turned out, could not come, having gone to New Cranton to see a young drummer, her first boyfriend, sail off into the sunrise with his regiment. But Greg had to be asked to come after all. On the previous day, he had called on her bringing a talisman from his very sick father, who wanted Ada to treasure as much as his granddam had, a little camel of yellow ivory carved in Kiev 5 centuries ago, in the days of Timur and Nabok. Van did not err in believing that Ada remained unaffected by Greg's devotion. He now met him again with pleasure, a kind of pleasure immoral in its very purity, which adds its icy tang to the friendly feelings a successful rival bears toward a thoroughly decent fellow. Greg, who had left his splendid new black Silentium motorcycle in the forest ride, observed, "We have company."
"Indeed we do," assented Van. "Kutosi. Who are they? Do you have any idea?"
Nobody had. Raincoated, unpainted, morose. Marina came over and peered through the trees the way Van pointed. After reverently inspecting the Silentium, a dozen elderly townsmen in dark clothes, shabby and uncouth, walked into the forest across the road and sat down there to a modest colazione of cheese, buns, salami, sardines, and Chianti. They were quite sufficiently far from our picnickers not to bother them in any way. They had no mechanical music boxes with them. Their voices were subdued,
Their movements could not have been more discreet. The predominant gesture seemed to be ritually limited to this or that fist crumpling brown paper or coarse gazette paper or baker's paper, the very lightweight and inefficient sort, and discarding the crumpled bit in quiet, abstract fashion, while other sad, apostolic hands unwrapped the victuals or, for some reason or other, wrapped them up again in the noble shade of the pines, in the humble shade of the false acacias. "How odd," said Marina, scratching her sunlit bald patch. She sent a footman to investigate the situation and tell those gypsy politicians or Calabrian laborers that Squire Veen would be furious if he discovered trespassers camping in his woods. The footman returned, shaking his head. They did not speak English. Vaughn went over. "Please go away. This is private property," said Vaughn in vulgar Latin, French, Canadian French, Russian, Yukonian Russian, very low Latin again, proprietà privata. He stood looking at them, hardly noticed by them, hardly shade-touched by the foliage. They were ill-shaven, blue-jowled men in old Sunday suits. One or two wore no collar but had kept the thyroid stud. One had a beard and a humid squint. Patent boots with dust in the cracks or orange-brown shoes, either very square or very pointed, had been taken off and pushed under the burdocks or placed on the old tree stumps of the rather drab clearing. How odd indeed! When Vaughn repeated his request, the intruders started to mutter among themselves in a totally incomprehensible jargon, making small flapping motions in his direction, as if half-heartedly chasing away a gnat. He asked Marina, did she want him to use force? But sweet dear Marina said, patting her hair, one hand on her hip, "No, let us ignore them," especially as they were now drawing a little deeper into the trees. "Look, look, some dragging, a reculant, the various parts of their repast upon what resembled an old bedspread, which receded like a fishing boat pulled over pebbly sand, while others politely removed the crumpled wrappings to other more distant hiding places in keeping with the general relocation. A most melancholy and meaningful picture. But meaning what? What?" Gradually their presence dissolved from Vaughn's mind. Everybody was now having a wonderful time. Marina threw off the pale raincoat, or rather, dust coat, she had put on for the picnic. After all, with one thing and another, her domestic gray dress with the pink fichu was quite gay enough, she declared, for an old lady. And raising an empty glass, she sang, with brio and very musically, the green grass aria, "Replenish, replenish the glasses with wine. Here's a toast to love, to the rapture of love." With awe and pity and no love, Vaughn kept reverting to that poor bald patch on Travertiata's poor old head, to the scalp burnished by her hair dye, an awful pine rust color, much shinier than her dead hair. He attempted, as so many times before, to squeeze out some fondness for her, but as usual failed, and as usual told himself that Ada did not love her mother either, a vague and cowardly consolation. Greg, assuming with touching simplicity that Ada would notice and approve, showered Mademoiselle La Riviere with a thousand little attentions, helping her out of her mauve jacket, pouring out for her the milk into Lucette's mug from a thermos bottle, passing the sandwiches, replenishing Mademoiselle La Riviere's wine glass, and listening with a rapt grin to her diatribes against the English, whom she said she disliked even more than the Tartars or the, well, Assyrians. "England," she cried, "England, the country where for every poet there are 99 sales petits bourgeois, some of suspect extraction. England dares ape France. I have in that hamper there an English novel of high repute in which a lady is given a perfume, an expensive perfume, called Ombre Chevalier, which is really nothing but a fish. A delicious fish, true, but hardly suitable for scenting one's handkerchief with. On the very next page, a soi-disant philosopher mentions un acte gratuit, as if all acts were feminine, and a soi-disant Parisienne hotel keeper in the story says, je me regrette for je regrette.
The core, interjected Vaughan. But what about such atrocious bloomers in French translations from the English, as for example, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, at that very moment, Ada emitted a Russian exclamation of utmost annoyance as a steel-gray convertible glided into the glade. No sooner had it stopped than it was surrounded by the same group of townsmen, who now seemed to have multiplied in strange consequence of having shed coats and waistcoats. Thrusting his way through their circle, with every sign of wrath and contempt, young Percy Dupré, frilled-shirted and white-trousered, strode up to Marina's deck chair. He was invited to join the party despite Ada's trying to stop her silly mother with an admonishing stare and a private small shake of the head.
I dared not hope.
Oh, I accept with great pleasure, answered Percy. Whereupon, the seemingly forgetful but in reality calculating bland bandit marched back to his car, near which a last wonderstruck admirer lingered, to fetch a bouquet of long-stemmed roses stored in the boot.
What a shame that I should loathe roses, said Ada, accepting them gingerly.
The Muscat wine was uncorked, Ada's and Ida's healths drunk. The conversation became general, as Montparnasse liked to write.
Count Percy Dupré turned to Ivan Demyanovich Vine.
I'm told you like abnormal positions.
The half-question was half-mockingly put. Vaughan looked through his raised lunel at the honeyed sun.
Meaning what?
He inquired.
Well, that walking on your hands trick. One of your aunt's servants is the sister of one of our servants, and two pretty gossips form a dangerous team.
Laughing.
The legend has it that you do it all day long, in every corner. Congratulations.
Bowing. Vaughan replied, the legend makes too much of my specialty. Actually, I practice it for a few minutes every other night, don't I, Ada? Looking around for her. May I give you, Count, some more of the mouse and cat? Poor pun, but mine.
Vaughan, dear, said Marina,
who was listening with delight to the handsome young man's vivacious and carefree prattle.
Tell him about your success in London. Je t'en prie, please.
Yes, said Vaughan. It all started as a rag, you know, up at shows, but then...
Vaughan, called Ada shrilly. I want to say something to you. Vaughan, come here.
Dorn, flipping through a literary review to Trigorin, here, a couple of months ago, a certain article was printed, a letter from America, and I wanted to ask you incidentally, taking Trigorin by the waist and leading him to the front of the stage, because I'm very much interested in that question. Ada stood with her back against the trunk of a tree like a beautiful spy who has just rejected the blindfold.
I wanted to ask you incidentally, Vaughan, continuing in a whisper with an angry flick of the wrist, stop playing the perfect idiot host. He came drunk as a whelt, can't you see?
The execution was interrupted by the arrival of Uncle Dan. He had a remarkably reckless way of driving, as happens so often, goodness knows why, in the case of many dour, dreary men. Weaving rapidly between the pines, he brought the little red runabout to an abrupt stop in front of Ada, and presented her with the perfect gift, a big box of mints, white, pink, and, oh boy, green. He also had an aerogram for her, he said, winking. Ada tore it open, and saw it was not for her from dismal Caligano, as she had feared, but for her mother from Los Angeles, a much gayer place. Marina's face gradually assumed an expression of quite indecent youthful beatitude as she scanned the message. Triumphantly, she showed it to La Riviere Montparnasse, who read it twice and tilted her head with a smile of indulgent disapproval. Positively stamping her feet with joy,
Pedro is coming again, cried, gurgled, rippled Marina to her calm daughter. And I suppose he'll stay till the end of the summer, remarked Ada, and sat down with Greg and Lucette for a game of snap on a lap robe spread over the little ants and dry pine needles. Oh no, Danietja, only for a fortnight, girlishly giggling. After that, we shall go to Husai Golivudtoj. Marina was really in great form. Yes, we shall all go, the author and the children, and Van, if he wishes.
I wish, but I can't, said Percy, sample of his humor.
In the meantime, Uncle Dan, very dapper in cherry-striped blazer and variety comic straw hat, feeling considerably intrigued by the presence of the adjacent picnickers, walked over to them with his glass of hero wine in one hand and a caviar canapé in the other.
The accursed children, said Marina in answer to something Percy wanted to know.
Percy, you were to die very soon, and not from that pellet in your fat leg on the turf of a Crimean ravine, but a couple of minutes later when you opened your eyes and felt relieved and secure in the shelter of the Mackie. You were to die very soon, Percy, but that July day in Lodore County, lolling under the pines, royally drunk after some earlier festivity, with lust in your heart and a sticky glass in your strong, blonde-haired hand, listening to a literary bore, chatting with an aging actress and ogling her sullen daughter, you reveled in the spicy situation, old sport, chin-chin, and no wonder. Burly, handsome, indolent and ferocious, a crack rugger player, a cracker of country girls, you combined the charm of the off-duty athlete with the engaging drawl of a fashionable ass. I think what I hated most about your handsome moon face was that baby complexion, the smooth-skinned jaws of the easy shaver. I had begun to bleed every time, and was going to do so for 7 decades. In a birdhouse fixed to that pine trunk, said Marina to her young admirer, there was once a telephone. How I'd welcome its presence right now. Ah, here he is, enfant. Her husband, minus the glass and the canapé, strolled back bringing wonderful news. They were an exquisitely polite group. He had recognized at least a dozen Italian words. It was, he understood, a collation of shepherds. He thought, he was a shepherd too. A canvas from Cardinal Carlo de' Medici's collection, author unknown, may have been at the base of that copy. Excitedly, overexcitedly, the little man said he insisted the servants take viands and wine to his excellent new friends. He got busy himself, seizing an empty bottle and a hamper that contained knitting equipment, an English novel by Quigley, and a roll of toilet paper. Marina explained, however, that professional obligations demanded she call up California without delay, and forgetting his project, he readily consented to drive her home. Mists have long since hidden the links and loops of consecutive events, but approximately while that departure took place, or soon after, Van found himself standing on the brink of the brook, which had reflected 2 pair of superimposed eyes earlier in the afternoon, and chucking pebbles with Percy and Greg at the remnants of an old, rusty, indecipherable signboard on the other side. Och, nado, I must, pasati, exclaimed Percy in the Slavic slang he affected, blowing his cheeks out and fumbling frantically at his fly. In all his life, said stolid Greg to Vaughn, he had never seen such an ugly engine. Surgically circumcised, terrifically oversized and high-colored, with such a phenomenal coup de boeuf. Nor had either of the fascinated, fastidious boys ever witnessed the like of its sustained, strongly arched, practically everlasting stream.
Phew!
Uttered the young man with relief, and repacked. How did the scuffle start? Did all 3 cross the brook, stepping on slimy stones? Did Percy push Greg? Did Vaughn jog Percy? Was there something? A stick? Twisted out of a fist? A wrist gripped and freed?
Oh-ho, said Percy. You are playful, my lad.
Greg, one bag of his plus fours soaked, watched them helplessly. He was fond of both as they grappled on the brink of the brook. Percy was 3 years older and a score of kilograms heavier than Vaughn, but the latter had handled even burlier brutes with ease. Almost at once, the Count's bursting face was trapped in the crook of Vaughn's arm. The grunting Count toured the turf in a hunched-up stagger. He freed one scarlet ear, was retrapped, was tripped, and collapsed under Vaughn, who instantly put him on his omoplates, na no pachti, as King Wing used to say in his carpet jargon. Percy lay panting like a dying gladiator, both shoulder blades pressed to the ground by his tormentor, whose thumbs now started to manipulate horribly that heaving thorax. Percy, with a sudden bellow of pain, intimated he had had enough. Vaughn requested a more articulate expression of surrender and got it. Greg, fearing Vaughn had not caught the muttered plea for mercy, repeated it in the third-person interpretive. Vaughn released the unfortunate Count, whereupon he sat up, spitting, palpating his throat, rearranging the rumpled shirt around his husky torso, and asking Greg in a husky voice to find a missing cufflink. Vaughn washed his hands in a lower shelf pool of the brook and recognized, with amused embarrassment, the transparent tubular thing, not unlike a sea squirt, that had got caught in his downstream course in a fringe of forget-me-nots. Good name, too. He had started to walk back to the picnic glade when a mountain fell upon him from behind. With one violent heave, he swung his attacker over his head. Percy crashed and lay supine for a moment or two. Vaughn, his crab claws on the ready, contemplated him, hoping for a pretext to inflict a certain special device of exotic torture that he had not yet had the opportunity to use in a real fight.
"You've broken my shoulder,"
grumbled Percy, half rising and rubbing his thick arm.
"A little more self-control, young devil."
"Stand up," said Vaughn.
"Come on, stand up. Would you like more of the same, or shall we join the ladies?"
"The ladies? All right. But if you please, walk in front of me now." As he and his captive drew near the glade, Vaughn cursed himself for feeling rattled by that unexpected additional round. He was secretly out of breath. His every nerve twanged. He caught himself limping and correcting the limp, while Percy Dupre, in his magically immaculate white trousers and casually ruffled shirt, marched buoyantly exercising his arms and shoulders and seemed quite serene and, in fact, rather cheerful. Presently, Greg overtook them, bringing the cufflink, a little triumph of meticulous detection, and with a trite, "Attaboy," Percy closed his silk cuff, thus completing his insolent restoration. Their dutiful companion, still running, got first to the side of the finished feast. He saw Ada facing him with two stipple-stemmed red beletes in one hand and three in the other, and mistaking her look of surprise at the sound of his thudding hooves for one of concern, good Sir Greg hastened to cry out from afar, "He's all right! He's all right, Miss Veen!" Blind compassion preventing the young knight from realizing that she could not possibly have known yet what a clash had occurred between the bow and the beast.
"Indeed I am," said the former, taking from her a couple of her toadstools, the girl's favorite delicacy, and stroking their smooth caps. "And why shouldn't I be? Your cousin has treated Greg and your humble servant to a most bracing exhibition of Oriental scrotumoff, or whatever the name may be." He called for wine, but the remaining bottles had been given to the mysterious pastors whose patronage the adjacent clearing had already lost. They might have dispatched and buried one of their comrades if the stiff collar and reptilian tie left hanging from a locust branch were his. Gone also was the bouquet of roses which Ada had ordered to be put back into the boot of the Count's car. Better than waste them on her. Let him give them, she said, to Blanche's lovely sister. And now Mademoiselle La Riviere clapped her hands to rouse from their siesta Kim, the driver of her gig, and Trofim, the children's fair-bearded coachman. Ada reclenched her beletes, and all Percy could find for his handkuss was a cold fist.
"Jolly nice to have seen you, old boy," he said, tapping Vaughn lightly on the shoulder, a forbidden gesture in their milieu. "Hope to play with you again soon. I wonder," he added in a lower voice, "if you shoot as straight as you wrestle."
Vaughn followed him to the convertible.
Vaughn, come here. Greg wants to say goodbye," cried Ada,
but he did not return.
"Is that a challenge? Me faites-vous un duel?"
inquired Vaughn. Percy at the wheel smiled, slit his eyes, bent toward the dashboard, smiled again, but said nothing. Click, click went the motor, then broke into thunder, and Percy drew on his gloves.
"Quand tu voudras, mon gars,"
said Vaughn, slapping the fender and using the terrible second-person singular of duelists in old France. The car leapt forward and disappeared. Vaughn returned to the picnic ground, his heart stupidly thumping. He waved in passing to Greg, who was talking to Ada a little way off on the road.
"Really, I assure you," Greg was saying to her, "your cousin is not to blame. Percy started it and was defeated in a clean match of Korotum wrestling, as used in Terestan and Sorakat. My father, I'm sure, could tell you all about it." "You're a dear," answered Ada, "but I don't think your brain works too well."
"It never does in your presence," remarked Greg, and mounted his black silent steed, hating it and himself and the two bullies. He adjusted his goggles and glided away. Mademoiselle La Riviere, in her turn, got into her gig and was borne off through the speckled vista of the forest ride.
Lucette ran up to Vaughn and, almost kneeling, cozily embraced her big cousin around the hips and clung to him for a moment.
"Come along," said Vaughn, lifting her. "Don't forget your jersey. You can't go naked."
Ada strolled up.
"My hero," she said, hardly looking at him,
with that inscrutable air she had that let one guess whether she expressed sarcasm or ecstasy, or a parody of one or the other.
This is the end of disc number 8. Please insert disc number 9. This is disc number 9.
"Come along," said Vaughn, lifting her. "Don't forget your jersey. You can't go naked."
Ada strolled up.
"My hero," she said, hardly looking at him, with that inscrutable air she had that let one guess whether she expressed sarcasm or ecstasy, or a parody of one or the other.
Lucette, swinging her mushroom basket, chanted,
"He screwed off a nipple, he left him a cripple."
"Lucy Veen, stop that,"
shouted Ada at the imp, and Vaughn, with a show of great indignation, shook the little wrist he held while twinkling drolly at Ada on his other side. Thus, a carefree-looking young trio, they moved toward the waiting Victoria. Slapping his thighs in dismay, the coachman stood berating a tousled footboy who had appeared from under a bush. He had concealed himself there to enjoy in peace a tattered copy of Tattersalia, with pictures of tremendous, fabulously elongated racehorses, and had been left behind by the Cherubank, which had carried away the dirty dishes and the drowsy servants. He climbed onto the box beside Trofim, who directed a vibrating "trrp" at the backing bays, while Lucette considered with darkening green eyes the occupation of her habitual perch.
"You'll have to take her on your half-brotherly knee," said Ada, in a neutral apart.
"But won't La Maudite Riviere object?" he said absently, trying to catch by its tail the sensation of fate's rerun.
"La Riviere can go and—"
and Ada's sweet pale lips repeated Gavronsky's crude crack.
"That goes for Lucette too," she added.
"Vos vraies gens sont assez lestes," remarked Vaughn.
"Are you very mad at me?" "Oh, Vaughn, I'm not. In fact, I'm delighted you won. But I'm 16 today. 16. Older than grandmother at the time of her first divorce. It's my last picnic, I guess. Childhood is scrapped. I love you. You love me. Greg loves me. Everybody loves me. I'm glutted with love. Hurry up or she'll pull that cock off. Lucette, leave him alone at once.
Finally, the carriage started on its pleasant homeward journey.
Ouch!
Grunted Vaughn as he received the rounded load, explaining wryly that he had hit his right patella against a rock.
Of course, if one goes in for horseplay, murmured Ada,
and opened at its emerald ribbon the small, brown, gold-tooled book, a great success with the passing sunflex that she had been already reading during the ride to the picnic.
I do fancy a little horseplay, said Vaughn. It has left me with quite a tingle for more reasons than one. I saw you horse-playing, said Lucette, turning her head.
Shh, uttered Vaughn.
I mean you and him.
We are not interested in your impressions, girl, and don't look back all the time. You know you get carriage sick when the road...
Coincidence. Jean qui tâchait de lui tourner la tête, surfaced Ada briefly.
When the road runs out of you, as your sister once said when she was your age.
True, mused Lucette, tunefully.
She had been prevailed upon to clothe her honey-brown body. Her white jersey had filched a lot from its recent background, pine needles, a bit of moss, a cake crumb, a baby caterpillar. Her remarkably well-filled green shorts were stained with burnberry purple. Her ember-bright hair flew into his face and smelt of a past summer. Family smell. Yes, coincidence. A set of coincidences slightly displaced, the artistry of asymmetry. She sat in his lap, heavily, dreamily, full of foie gras and peach punch, and with the backs of her brown, iridescent bare arms almost touching his face, touching it when he glanced down right and left to check if the mushrooms had been taken. They had. The little footboy was reading and picking his nose, judging by the movements of his elbow. Lucette's compact bottom and cool thighs seemed to sink deeper and deeper in the quicksand of the dream-like, dream-rephrased, legend-distorted past. Ada, sitting next to him, turning her smaller pages quicker than the boy in the box, was, of course, enchanting, obsessive, eternal, and lovelier, more somberly ardent than 4 summers ago. But it was that other picnic which he now relived, and it was Ada's soft haunches which he now held as if she were present in duplicate, in 2 different color prints. Through strands of coppery silk he looked aslant at Ada, who puckered her lips at him in the semblance of a transmitted kiss, pardoning him at last for his part in that brawl, and presently went back to her vellum-bound little volume, Ombre et Couleur, an 1820 edition of Chateaubriand's short stories with hand-painted vignettes and the flat mummy of a pressed anemone. The gouts and glooms of the woodland passed across her book, her face and Lucette's right arm, on which he could not help kissing a mosquito bite in pure tribute to the duplication. Poor Lucette stole a languorous look at him and looked away again, at the red neck of the coachman, of that other coachman who for several months had haunted her dreams. We do not care to follow the thoughts troubling Ada, whose attention to her book was far shallower than might seem. We will not, nay, cannot follow them with any success, for thoughts are much more faintly remembered than shadows or colors or the throbs of young lust or a green snake in a dark paradise. Therefore, we find ourselves more comfortably sitting within Vaughn while his Ada sits within Lucette and both sit within Vaughn.
And all three in me, adds Ada.
He remembered with a pang of pleasure the indulgent skirt Ada had been wearing then, so swoony-balloony, as the Cho's young thing said, and he regretted, smiling, that Lucette had those chaste shorts on today, and Ada, husked corn, laughing, trousers. in the fatal course of the most painful ailments, sometimes, nodding gravely, sometimes there occur sweet mornings of perfect repose, and that not owing to some blessed pill or potion, indicating the bedside clutter, or at least without our knowing that the loving hand of despair slipped us the drug. Von closed his eyes in order better to concentrate on the golden flood of swelling joy. Many, oh, many, many years later, he recollected with wonder, how could one have endured such rapture, that moment of total happiness, the complete eclipse of the piercing and praying ache, the logic of intoxication, the circular argument to the effect that the most eccentric girl cannot help being faithful if she loves one as one loves her. He watched Ada's bracelet flash in rhythm with the swaying of the Victoria, and her full lips, parted slightly in profile, show in the sun the red pollen of a remnant of salve drying in the transversal thumbnail lines of their texture. He opened his eyes. The bracelet was indeed flashing, but her lips had lost all trace of rouge, and the certainty that in another moment he would touch their hot, pale pulp threatened to touch off a private crisis under the solemn load of another child. But the little proxy's neck, glistening with sweat, was pathetic. Her trustful immobility, sobering, and after all, no furtive friction could compete with what awaited him in Ada's bower. A twinge in his kneecap also came to the rescue, and honest Von chided himself for having attempted to use a little pauper instead of the princess in the fairy tale, whose precious flesh must not blush with the impression of a chastening hand, says Pierrot in Peterson's version. With the fading of that fugitive flame, his mood changed. Something should be said. A command should be given. The matter was serious or might become serious. They were now about to enter Gamlet, the little Russian village from which a birch-lined road led quickly to Ardis. A small procession of kerchiefed peasant nymphs, unwashed, no doubt, but adorably pretty, with naked, shiny shoulders and high-divided, plump breasts tuliped up by their corsets, walked past through a coppice, singing an old ditty in their touching English, "Thorns and nettles for silly girls, ah, torn the petals, ah, spilled the pearls." "You have a little pencil in your back pocket," said Von to Lucette. "May I borrow it? I want to write down that song."
"If you don't tickle me there," said the child.
Von reached for Ada's book and wrote on the flyleaf as she watched him with odd, wary eyes, "I don't wish to see him again. It's serious. Tell M not to receive him or I leave. No answer required." She read it and slowly, silently erased the lines with the top of the pencil, which she passed back to Von, who replaced it where it had been.
"You're awfully fidgety," Lucette observed without turning. "Next time," she added, "I won't have him dislodge me."
They now swept up to the porch, and Trofim had to cuff the tiny blue-coated reader in order to have him lay his book aside and jump down to hand Ada out of the carriage.